Introduction to the World is Flat, version 3.0. Why go through all the trouble of writing a second, expanded, and updated version of The World is Flat only a year after the first expanded version was published and a mere 2 years after the original? I can offer a very brief answer. Because I could, and because I had to. Precisely because of the powerful technological forces detailed in this book, the publishing industry has sped up, and it is now possible to revamp a whole book relatively easily. That is what I mean when I say I could. The reason I must do it is fourfold. First, the forces flattening the world didn't stop when the first edition of this book was published in April 2005. And I wanted to keep tracking them and weaving them into my overall thesis. Second, I wanted to answer one of the questions I was asked most often by parents while I was traveling around the country to speak about the book. Okay, Mr. Friedman, thank you for telling us that the world is flat. Now, what do I tell my kids? In the 2.0 edition, I added a lot more material on the subject of what is the right education to access the new middle-class jobs, and I have added still more in this 3.0 edition. Third, I found many of the comments from readers and reviewers both thoughtful and useful, and I wanted to absorb some of the best of them into the book. And finally, in this 3.0 edition, I have added two new chapters to deal with themes related to the flat world that were not apparent to me before, but now seem extremely important. One deals with how to be a political activist and social entrepreneur in a flat world. The other deals with a more troubling phenomenon, how we manage our reputations in a world where we are all becoming publishers and therefore all becoming public figures. This book has triggered a cottage industry of articles with variations on the title, The World is Not Flat. I have two reactions to these. One, no kidding. Two, whenever you opt for a big metaphor like the world is flat, you trade a certain degree of academic precision for a much larger degree of explanatory power. Of course, the world is not flat. But it isn't round anymore either. I have found that using the simple notion of flatness to describe how more people can plug, play, compete, connect, and collaborate with more equal power than ever before, which is what is happening in the world, really helps people who are trying to understand the essential impact of all the technological changes coming together today. Not only do I make no apologies for it, I think that with every passing year, it becomes more true and more useful in explaining in a simple way what is happening. My use of the word flat doesn't mean equal, as in equal incomes, and never did. It means equalizing, because the flattening forces are empowering more and more individuals today to reach farther, faster, deeper, and cheaper than ever before. And that is equalizing power and equalizing opportunity by giving so many more people the tools and ability to connect, compete, and collaborate. In my view, this flattening of the playing field is the most important thing happening in the world today. And those who get caught up in measuring globalization purely by trade statistics or as a purely economic phenomenon instead of one that affects everything from individual empowerment to culture to how hierarchical institutions operate are missing the impact of this change. At some point, I will stop writing this book. But for now, I am just enjoying the chance to keep sharing what I am learning and am thankful that the flattening of the world makes doing so easier than ever. Thomas L. Friedman, Washington, D.C., April 2007.
Audio Renaissance presents The World is Flat, a brief history of the 21st century, by Thomas L. Friedman. Read for you by Oliver Wyman. How the World Became Flat.
No one ever gave me directions like this on a golf course before. Aim at either Microsoft or IBM. I was standing on the first tee at the KGA Golf Club in downtown Bangalore in southern India when my playing partner pointed at two shiny glass and steel buildings off in the distance, just behind the first green. HP and Texas Instruments had their offices on the back nine, along the 10th hole. That wasn't all. The tee markers were from Epson, the printer company, and one of our caddies was wearing a hat from 3M. Outside, some of the traffic signs were also sponsored by Texas Instruments, and the Pizza Hut billboard on the way over showed a steaming pizza under the headline, Gigabytes of Taste. No, this definitely wasn't Kansas. It didn't even seem like India. Was this the new world, the old world, or the next world? I had come to Bangalore, India's Silicon Valley, on my own Columbus-like journey of exploration. Columbus sailed with the Niña, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria in an effort to discover a shorter, more direct route to India by heading west, across the Atlantic, on what he presumed to be an open sea route to the East Indies, rather than going south and east around Africa, as Portuguese explorers of his day were trying to do. He apparently assumed the Earth was round, which was why he was convinced that he could get to India by going west. He miscalculated the distance, though. He thought the Earth was a smaller sphere than it is. He also did not anticipate running into a landmass before he reached the East Indies. Nevertheless, he called the Aboriginal peoples he encountered in the New World Indians. Columbus was searching for hardware, precious metals, silk, and spices, the source of wealth in his day. I was searching for software, brain power, complex algorithms, knowledge workers, call centers, transmission protocols, breakthroughs in optical engineering, the sources of wealth in our day. Columbus was happy to make the Indians he met his slaves, a pool of free manual labor. I just wanted to understand why the Indians I met were taking our work. Why they had become such an important pool for the outsourcing of service and information technology work from America and other industrialized countries. Columbus had more than 100 men on his three ships. I had a small crew from the Discovery Times Channel that fit comfortably into two banged-up vans, with Indian drivers who drove barefoot. When I set sail, so to speak, I too assumed that the world was round. But what I encountered in the real India profoundly shook my faith in that notion. Columbus accidentally ran into America, but thought he had discovered part of India. I actually found India and thought many of the people I met there were Americans. Columbus reported to his king and queen that the world was round, and he went down in history as the man who first made this discovery. I returned home and shared my discovery only with my wife. And only in a whisper. "Honey," I confided, "I think the world is flat."